we're living in times with a really apocalyptic feel. And, you know, everywhere we look, there's war, political crisis, extreme weather, like we just had in Florida, drought, fire, flood. And I think there's an urgency and a sorrow in this, in the world, and for all of our generations, and I think especially for our younger generations. And I think that invites religious inquiry and poetic response. And I know for myself, I feel an impetus to try to do what I can to put light in the world. That's really all, the only way I can describe it, because I feel like that's the only thing I can offer, to put light into the world. And I believe that may be the motivation of others also.
We welcome back to our podcast the award-winning poet and theologian Laura Rees Hogan. Laura is the author of a study of Paul's theology titled I Live No Longer I, Paul's Spirituality of Suffering, Transformation, and Joy, published in 2017, and of the poetry collections Litany of Flights and Butterfly Nebula. It is that latter collection, published in 2023, we discuss today, an exploration of spiritual life by way of meditations on deep sea life and the far reaches of the cosmos. Laura is also with us in person as she is giving this semester's Distinguished Faith and Imagination Lecture at BYU. I'm Matthew Wickman of the BYU Faith and Imagination Institute. Laura Rees Hogan, it's a pleasure to welcome you here to BYU.
Thank you so much for inviting me here. I am thrilled to be here.
You've been here for a couple days. It's been a lot of fun. I thoroughly loved having you on campus here to do various things for us. There's more today. It bears saying for our listeners, Laura is the Faith and Imagination Lecturer this semester at BYU. This lecture originated a few years ago when I was directing the BYU Humanities Center. The Humanities Center sponsors the event. We hold it twice per year, once in each of the two main semesters, and had some really wonderful guests. And its purpose is for us at BYU to learn from writers and thinkers who are engaging faith, religion, and spiritual life in dynamic and creative ways. I was so excited, Laura, when you accepted our invitation to come and give this lecture. But I should say, you aren't only lecturing today at BYU, you're also giving a poetry reading. Yesterday, you met with faculty and students affiliated with our University Council for Interfaith Engagement and Interfaith Student Association, and you attended my class I'm teaching.
Which was wonderful.
It was so great having you there. And in that class, the students and I have been spending a few weeks discussing your work, and now you're sitting down for a podcast conversation. So you have been busy on campus.
Yes, and having a wonderful time. Thank you.
Listen, our pleasure. So you've been a guest on the podcast before, all right? We talked last time around about your beautiful poetry collection, Litany of Flights, award-winning collection. And today we're discussing your most recent award-winning collection of poems titled Butterfly Nebula. Let me ask you first about the transition from Litany of Flights to Butterfly Nebula. When I first read Litany of Flights, it struck me like a revelation. It really did. The poems were beautifully crafted. They were very smart. And they were deeply attuned to what I describe as the rhythms and the textures of religious and spiritual life. And several of the poems in that collection announced their religious and spiritual investments by thematizing episodes from the life of Jesus or perhaps the life of famous Christian figures like St. John of the Cross. And as we'll discuss, Butterfly Nebula is also very elegantly crafted. It's super smart. It's deeply spiritually attuned. But this new collection explores radically different and distant subjects, right? Like the far reaches of outer space and deep sea life. Can you tell us about what took you from the earlier collection to this later one? And do you see Butterfly Nebula as a continuation of earlier work, or is it a departure in some ways?
I would say that the poems in Litany of Flights are more centered on the natural world as we encounter it in the ordinary, say in backyards or on hikes. And Butterfly Nebula is a departure from that, plunging into realms of the deep sea, far reaches of space. Yet both collections are concerned with the physical universe and the divine and where we are in that. And looking back, I can see in elements of Litany of Flights, sort of precursor to Butterfly Nebula, and strangely, or even prophetically, the very last poem in Litany of Flight's Substance Theory ends up on an image of outer space.
Even
mentioning the word nebula, I had no idea, of course,
that's right.
that yeah. I would be writing Butterfly Nebula next, but that's there. And I think part of the transition was the pandemic. I started writing Butterfly Nebula at the beginning of the pandemic, and like everyone in lockdown at that time, and there was such a sense of isolation and confinement.
Deep space away from everybody.
Yes, deep space away from everyone, but also my imagination wanted wide open spaces.
Yeah, okay.
So I went swimming in the deep ocean, and I, you know, went to these really crazy far reaches of space as a tonic almost.
Yeah.
And also I found it wonderful to search for patterns in those places that might give us insights about the human condition.
Okay. Well, I would love to read and discuss a few of the poems from this new collection, if that's okay with you. I want to give
Absolutely.
Our listeners a feel for it. And perhaps we can start with one of the poems about deep space. This is Oyster Nebula on page 13. I'm wondering, would you read this poem for us?
I would love to. Thank you. So it has an epigraph from Matthew 13:46. When he finds a pearl of great price, he goes and sells all that he has and buys it. Oyster Nebula. You knew I trade away everything I have for you. You knew I'd fall in love with your radiance, tender and consuming. My fingers drop the moon and sun to reach for you beyond space and inscribed here across fleshy grooves where the irritant must lodge in the crease of nebular tongue, gloss layered gossamer over each ripped veil. Last night I dreamed blood inside the body was blue, blue as sapphire, rainy as indigo. That blood was only red when struck and drawn from the body. Hidden blue of my heart vein, you sift your grain of sand until I shift iridescent, until I break red and bead into milky pink rose. I tell you a mystery. Astronomers see the brightness of the nebulous pearl as variable, conclude it is two stars, though observing only one pulse, a single glazed shine.
Beautiful. Bravo. Mm-hmm. I love Thank that you. Poem. Here's why I wanted us to read this one. I think in some respects it captures features of the collection as a whole. Things that stand out to me about the poem. So you have that epigraph from the Gospel of Matthew. It's a familiar biblical verse, right? When he finds a pearl of great price, he goes and sells all that he has and buys it. And the opening lines are kind of familiar language for Christian discipleship, right? You knew I'd trade away everything that I have for you. You knew I'd fall in love with your radiance, tender and consuming. But then the poem takes this turn. Right, this really interesting turn. And what seems at first to be a simple metaphor, you know, the supplicant here, the speaker, the poet, declaring her fingers drop the moon and sun to reach for God, it becomes a much more elaborate poetic conceit of a nebula. There's something kind of evocative for me, like almost like John Donne and kind of the extended and intricate nature of this metaphor. It's really beautiful. But then the concluding lines bring this conceit and the declaration of devotion together so beautifully. I'm just at the last 3.5 lines. I tell you a mystery. Astronomers see the brightness of the nebulous pearl as variable, concluded as two stars, though observing only one pulse, a single glazed shine. It's just a lovely way to bring that all back together again. I'm interested in this conceit you use in this poem, this elaborate astral metaphor. Here's my question, and it's a question about a lot of these poems. Does the exotic grandeur, you know, of these celestial bodies, these things in far-off space, which are so different from familiar everyday life and experience, does their exoticism make them easier to use in some ways poetically, or is it quite the opposite? Is it that their exotic unfamiliarity almost pulls the metaphors apart for you and focuses you on the object itself, trying to describe it because it is so different and so distant from our experience.
Oh, it is. And I would say the short answer is it was challenging. And of course, that's a challenge throughout this book. Although I loved taking these celestial objects as subjects, it was tricky to create all the layers I needed to in the poem to kind of counter the gravitational pull, if you will, of these vast objects, to kind of blow them apart and into something a reader could resonate with, to leave space in the poem and openness for the reader. But my favorite aspect of taking these celestial objects, especially the nebulae, as key metaphors in the book, was they offer almost inconceivable swaths of distance and power and time, a perspective that is just kind of not here on Earth or readily available to us. A nebula is just otherworldly enough, just vast enough, just strange enough, but it's also just real, just real enough to be a useful lens for our own realities here. So a nebula, to my mind, is a paradox. It's a star nursery. Stars are born there. But a nebula often comes about through a supernova, which, as you know, is the death of a star. So for me, a nebula kind of became this nexus of death and life, of deconstruction and reconstruction, or just change. There are thousands of classified nebulae in the universe, and I wrote a lot of poems about them, but I chose just 12 for this book to kind of stud the narrative arc of the book and hopefully give that shift of perspective that would kind of help us disclose truths very close to home, even though I'm talking about these nebulae.
Yeah, it's a great way to sort of design and you mentioned stud or kind of structure this collection. It's beautiful. And actually, the five sections of the book all have these great, sort of, you know, section one, Hydra, and you have like this constellation, right? And section two, I can find it quickly. Yeah, here we go, like Microscopium, and another constellation. It's a beautiful structuring device. The students yesterday in my class asked you about how you kind of wrote these things. Do you have a deep science background? Is this all like familiar to you, or did it require research? And if it required research, how did you convert research into poetry?
So I don't have a formal science background at all, but I have always had a curiosity and interest in science and have read about physics and astronomy. But the research for this book really focused on the individual cosmic objects, or in some cases, creatures. Odd creatures appear a lot in the book, deep sea creatures, land creatures. And typically, I would really delve very deeply into that subject, my chosen subject, for up to a week or longer, and research and read a lot about it and let it sit. And then I would just start free writing and see kind of what connections were there. And slowly my free writing would turn into verse.
Okay, there we go. And I mean, it's a beautiful verse. In fact, you just mentioned deep sea creatures. I wonder if we can read another poem from the collection. This is the Elysia Sea Slugs. We've gone from far reaches of outer space and nebulae down to the deep ocean here. And I wonder, can I read this poem? So it also has an epigraph, and it's from Ezekiel. And here's the epigraph. I will give you a new heart and place a new spirit within you, taking from your bodies your stony hearts and giving you natural hearts. That's from Ezekiel chapter 36. So, the Elysia Sea Slug. Things go sideways. The body opens the wrong doors and lets in bad company, copepods that take over. Then we carry it, segments crippled with parasites, stony growth. I think you mean it when you say, you'll give me a new heart. I see evidence in stars, in the sea slug that can detach its entire diseased body and crawl away an orange horned antenna. The head births a new form. Mangled sea stars and flatworms do this, but only the Elysia sea slug sprouts a head sprouts a heart from just a head. This is your prescription. You pry loose the cargo and craft fresh strands of light. When I unhook all the parts and struggle away, won't you come rebuild? Tear down the years the locusts have eaten. Let the heavy consignment fall. Regenerate a glistening wholeness from only one piece. Let that piece be you. Okay, beautiful. Can you tell us about this poem? Mm.
Thank you so much. It was lovely to hear you read the poem. So when I first encountered the Alesia sea slug, I knew I wanted to use that incredible image in connection with that Ezekiel epigraph you read. What does it mean for God to give us a new heart? And I loved the concept of the sea slug literally detaching its body and somehow generating a new heart from just ahead. And I love thinking about that in terms of what it means for us as humans. What has to fall apart kind of in our lives, in ourselves, in our interior, in our exterior? What has to fall away? And then what has to be rebuilt or built brand new, both inside and outside, in the person herself and in her life? When I was also really surprised when I was writing the poem how it did turn into the struggle of letting things fall away and the pain of that, even while this speaker was able to kind of lean back into that trust that we have to have in God to provide a path forward in a new life.
I love that. You know, in your book of theology, I Live No Longer I, you talk about Paul's theology, and there's kind of a tripartite theology you outline there of kenosis, enosis, and theosis. First part, kind of an emptying, right? A paring away. Second part, an enosis, a sense of community, of God with us. And then theosis, the transformation that comes from that. You know, yesterday in a small meeting that we had with some colleagues of mine and students, one of them evoked that line from Romans chapter 12, right, where Paul says, be not conformed to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds. And I thought about this poem, right, because that renewal from the mind is partly what generates that heart. And with a sea slug, it's the same kind of process.
Yes.
When you are writing a poem like this, are you thinking at all about Paul's theology? I mean, you've written about Paul's theology. You know it very well. Is it a conscious thing, or is it just so much a part of who you are and how you think that it's almost like second nature?
It really is just a part of who I am at this point, that kind of intuitive knowing that the stripping away, the emptying and the loss that we all experience in life at some point or another, that is going to be utilized in the spiritual life, that it is kind of a natural movement in the spiritual life, that kenosis or emptying, but that I will cycle back around to other powerful moments that include enosis, my encounter with God through community or creation, and in theosis, that divine transformative touch of God. So it's almost being aware of that rhythm at such an intuitive level. It doesn't take away the hurt sometimes, you know, the pain of it. But it does, there is a consolation in connection with those other two types of relationship with God.
Yeah, okay, so I was just thinking as you were saying that, I'm wondering, is it the point now where when you do feel these moments of painful brokenness, you know, as they come in life, as they do to all of us, when they come to you at this point, are they painful the same way they would have been in earlier stages of your life? Or when you feel it now, is it more like you come to recognize the pattern of how God works with you in such that you recognize that, okay, pain in the moment, but something consolatory is coming, therefore the pain is experienced differently. I guess what I'm asking is the pain still as painful and therefore the renewal as rejuvenating, or is the pain changed because you understand the pattern whereby God works with you and others?
So a pain is pain is pain.
Yeah, okay.
And pain is very difficult. And I do think I can put it in context much more quickly now. And I do know it will come around. But I would just say two other things. And one is the thing that kind of saves me most now in my spiritual life, I've almost reached a point of a feeling of unity with God in those very moments of pain. I mean, our God suffered. And so I feel like I've come to sort of that, thankfully, at a deeper level. And at the same time, I will say our God is always challenging us.
Yeah.
So I feel like I've been challenged even more, even as I've had the grace and the gift of that unitive experience of it, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. It does. I mentioned one more thing I love about that poem, the Elysia Sea Slug. I told you before, we talked on this podcast before, and I told you just in our conversations that I think you're a master at crafting these kind of spiritual epiphanies. By the way, you conclude the poems, right? You bring them to these interesting places. You know, and in this poem, it begins by just a description of this very strange creature. I've never had a sea slug as a pet, okay?
You know, that's I'm not sure I would want to.
Exactly right, right? It's a strange creature. It's a great, very vivid description. But somewhere, you know, along the way, this description converts into a prayer. And the way this ends, you know, when you ask that question, you know, when I unhook all the parts and struggle away, won't you come rebuild and then tear down the years, the locusts of Eden, let the heavy consignment fall, regenerate a glistening wholeness from only one piece, let that peace be you, that invocation. It's a prayer. I think it's a beautiful turn in the poem. I love it.
Thank you so much, Matt.
Now, this is a collection full of poems that I just find beautiful and so thoughtful. This is an unfair question, but I'll ask it anyway because I ask unfair questions sometimes. Is there a poem in this collection you especially love?
No.
I told you, unfair question, I told you.
It's a very unfair question.
Yes.
They're all my children. No.
That's right.
I love so many of these poems, and honestly, different of these kind of come to me at different moments and are my favorites or my companions, you know, as I'm going along. But one coming to me right now, because we've just talked about what we've talked about and, you know, a little bit of struggles in the spiritual life, is St. Teresa's Pillow.
Would you read that poem for us? I'd love to
oh, sure.
Have you
yes.
read it and talk about it.
That.
And tell us about why this poem also is one that comes to you in our conversation.
Yeah, so I just speaking about the Elysia Sea Slug, difficulties in spiritual life, and God pushing us forward, this poem is coming to mind because it does for me relate to God taking us out of our comfort zone, sometimes in a very kind of unwelcome way. And what kind of originally inspired this poem was I was very blessed to be able to go to Avila in Spain many, many years ago now. And one object in St. Teresa of Avila's convent really struck me. So this is St. Teresa's pillow. Splintered block of wood, grooved, now behind glass in the Avila monastery. What dreams, if she could sleep? Did she lie supine or turn to press her skull, ear painful, to listen for what is rigid, immobile? I am thinking of the slender neck ossifying at that angle. Sometimes it hurts too much to move ourselves. God tossed her like a rag doll from a horse into 7 inches of muck. If this is how you treat your friends, she could get sassy with her love. Then no wonder you have so few. But he knows what he's about, knows when to throw us hard, when to carve away the comfort of ruts, bolt us, jolt us like Jacob to wrangle the dark, dazzling weight of an angel. Your unbearable finger thrusts, unhinges my contending hip. What did you think this rising from the mud would look like? Of the stone pillow, we make an altar, pour oil. If we dream painful, hear the new name.
I love that poem. It's so beautiful. You know, if you could see this, if the listeners could see this on the page, there are things about it that are really remarkable. It's written in these unrhymed couplets, but there are these spaces, these gaps in the individual lines, right? All the way down. It opens on, you know, kind of like lowercase splintered. It's not a sentence. It doesn't end with a full stop. It's as though we're in the middle of a larger conversation that's happening with Teresa, which of course was an extended conversation she has. And it captures so beautifully the nature of the kind of experience you read about in some of her writing. That's some pillow, right? The splintered block of wood.
Mm-hmm.
I did not use that last night, thank heaven. It's also a poem that's very funny. And I mean, in the middle of this, right? So God tossed her like a rag doll from a horse into 7 inches of muck. If this is how you treat your friends, she gets sassy. Starling and I were kind of laughing as you're reading that. I'm trying to kind of keep it off the microphone. I love this. Can I ask you a question about this? Was this poem... So you had to do research on things like nebulae. You had to do research on things like sea slugs. You've been to Avila, and you've read Lives of Saints. Was the research different for this kind of a poem than it is for the others? Was it the same process to get to the place you could write a poem like this one?
Yes, this was very different. I'm a Third Order Carmelite, so I'm very familiar with her life, St. Teresa's life. And so I know this story about how she was thrown off a horse into the mud, and she said out loud, so others heard her, if this is how you treat your friends, then no wonder you have so few. And that's always stuck with me. And that is, to me, that captures so much of her personality, which was this really practical, brilliant, but kind of a little at times sassy, I think. And I love that. But I already know her. I feel that I know her personality so well. The image of the block of wood, I mean, that was, again, just so blessed to actually be able to actually see that. So that was sort of research long ago, though. So really, for me, for this poem, that just all kind of came together. The interesting thing for me about this poem was this idea of a new name. So identity comes up in this collection, and the new name.
Yes,
and
it's a motif.
Yeah, it is. And so the struggling with God and Jacob was the revelation for me in this poem, that this, you know, God is pulling us outside of our comfort zone, and we're wrestling against it, but there is a gift there. It's sort of this new identity. It was the case for Teresa. She was being called to do greater and greater, you know, things, and create brand new things that no one had ever really created before. It's the case of Jacob. He was literally given the new name, Israel. And so I loved those two coming together in this poem. It's a story that kind of gives us a little bit of hope as we're called out of our comfort zone into maybe something else that God has for us. It is a new piece of our identity. It is a new name. So that was sort of the discovery here.
Okay. It's a beautiful poem. And I love it in the collection. Yesterday in our class, a student actually brought attention to this poem here also, right? And so it struck a lot of us who've been reading these poems very carefully for the last couple weeks. I'm wondering, if you were giving this poem as a gift to a friend, would you give it to a friend who was in grief? Would you give it to a friend at a moment of spiritual high? Would you give it to a friend you wanted to encourage to sort of think about new things? I mean, at what state of life or spiritual life is someone best equipped to receive a poem like this one?
Oh, I do think there has to be some level of spiritual foundation and maturity to actually receive this poem as a gift, because and take it in, because there's struggle involved here, and it's an invitation to lean into that struggle and to push past it for the newness and grace that might lie beyond it. But it does involve participation in being outside your comfort zone, and that's challenging. So I'm not sure it would be a welcome gift in all cases.
Yeah, but no, it's a beautiful poem. Can we read one more from the collection? And maybe we can read the one that closes the collection, the last one, which is this beautiful poem titled Blue Moon Butterfly. It was first published in the Christian Century, and a colleague of mine at BYU, you heard this yesterday, had read it there and thought, that's amazing, and I made a photocopy and pinned it up on his wall in his office.
Amazing.
Which I love this poem. Would you read this poem for us?
I would love to.
Thank you.
Blue Moon Butterfly. Let me see the wick of wing, white moons surrounded by blue-violet halos etching the black. Let me remember it is also not that. Let me be the compound eye which slivers the ultraviolet spectrum, populates the invisible we call hope, which is also not that. When will you come, Lord? We have asked over the ages, over the surfaces that trick light, over structures which overlay all. Iridescent eye spots, blue the moon, shiver the signal. Your touch tender, silver bloomed, lapis ripe. When you come, Lord, there is no when, only a different light. Let me not forget.
Such a beautiful poem, and such a great concluding line for the collection. Not just for the poem, but for the collection as a whole. It really is. Just to kind of situate readers for a second here. So the poem opens by talking about this creature, this blue moon butterfly, which is actually, at least online, I looked it up on Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. It's a name they use in New Zealand for a certain kind of butterfly.
Yes.
Right? So when you're talking about these white moons, et cetera, surrounded by blue violet halos, just explain to the listener what that even means.
I do try to, when I was writing this collection, I tried to be very faithful to the characteristics of everything that I was kind of examining, whether it's a nebula or a butterfly. So in this case, I'm actually sort of describing the appearance of the actual blue moon butterfly.
Yeah, great. And then you say, let me see the wick of wings. Let me see this butterfly. Let me see kind of the way it appears. See these white moons, these halos, but etching the black. Remember, it's also not that. And then let me be the compound eye. This is like the insect eye that's actually composed of several receptors inside, like, you know, hundreds, thousands, however many there are in an insect's eye, that has a different way of getting at light. It sees light differently than we see it, right?
And in fact, can perceive much more than we can with our eyes.
Great.
Which was the motivation.
Right. So, you know, let me be the compound eye which slivers the ultraviolet spectrum, populates the invisible we call hope, which is also not that. Yeah, this is a beautiful poem. You know, at some level, it really is a plaintive poem at root. That question in the middle, when will you come, Lord? We have asked over the ages, right? Mm-hmm. And where the poem concludes is so moving, with the insight that when you come, Lord, there is no when, only a different light. And it struck me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but what the poem's describing isn't so much kind of a second coming, a messianic grand appearance, a one-time event. It's more a recognition that Christ's presence may be felt more frequently and more intimately. than that. And the point of turning in the poem, that moment of epiphany, this recognition of this, is bound up in these beautiful lines about the poet's experience of the divine presence. Right? Your touch, tender, silver-bloomed, lapis ripe. I mentioned this to you the other night. That's such a great image, because there, at one level, there's no such thing as a silver-bloomed touch, right? And yet it's so evocative and creates such a picture. It creates this reality. So on one hand, it's very real and very palpable, very tangible. On the other hand, it's outside of our experience. In that respect, it kind of replicates the divine presence, which is felt so intimately and so real. It's just, it's right there. You recognize it. And yet it's not anything reducible to everyday human experience typically, right? And so yes. It captures that so beautifully. And once it gets to that place, the poem then comes to this kind of different understanding, right? When you come, Lord, there is no when, only a different light, a light now recognized by way of that divine touch, that the metaphors that capture it, let me not forget. Just a beautiful poem, Laura. Love it.
Thank you so much, Matt.
Here is a question I want to ask you about it. And so to what extent does a poem like this express the kinds of layered spiritual experiences, right? You know, joy and woe bound up together that are known to most seekers of God, right? Who are familiar with both these things, often overlaying each other. And to what extent does a poem like this one actually open up in you spiritual channels that you might not have realized were there? I mean, to what extent are you describing what you already know? And to what extent does a poem like this one create new perceptions you might not have had?
Well, I think authentic spiritual experience is layered. I think it's usually, it's always a moving target. It's always in action. And is characterized by paradox, I think, often. And I think we see all these qualities running through poetic texts, like you're describing, like in the Psalms, for example, where we have text of joy and of woe, you know, all bound up together. I love poems that are spoken by a speaker in the thick of pain and doubt. And yet, they're still devotional poems telling us about who God is, a God that is sort of beyond that, that's still a God of love and hope, and because I think that sparks joy, and that does always open channels in me. And I think very often, a speaker like that, who doesn't identify, especially at certain moments in our life? So it's kind of a healing experience to be reading this other voice that's speaking to God. You're in community with that voice in a way, expressing pain. And yet at the same time, this speaker is also reinforcing your own faith back in this transcendent God.
That's beautiful. I love that. And when I read this poem, like when I read it initially, I thought of my own experience, you know, which kind of corresponds to what you're describing. I'll say though too, right, when I get to those lines about, you know, your touch tender, silver-bloomed, lapis ripe, I thought, you know, it on the one hand, it's familiar and I recognize that. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I think to myself, I've not had language for that quite like that. This touch that is both unlike any other touch and deeply familiar, but also radically surprising and unfamiliar. So the poem both corresponds with my experience and gives me new language for which I'm so grateful.
Yes, I mean, when we're talking about the divine, language doesn't really always work. We have to push those boundaries. And that's why I love creating, you know, something like you're describing, because it retains that element of the edge of sort of what we know and what we don't.
Right. Yeah, it's great. That's kind of a good transition. I wanted to ask you about this. So yesterday you visited my class, and this is a class I'm teaching this semester at the intersection of poetry and spiritual life. And as you saw and discussed with us, our class is reading a number of religious poets, and we're focusing what we're calling poetry as a way of spiritual life, or poetry as a stylistics of spiritual existence. That's a phrase we kind of borrowed and adapted from another a thinker, a critic, a philosopher. What that means is that we're asking how poetry and spiritual life give expansive expression to each other. Okay, how poetry opens channels of spiritual discernment in us, and how our own spiritual experiences help us understand poetry more deeply. So each side inflecting the other, poetry and spiritual experience. Mm-hmm. You're a poet, so do you think in these terms, either as a poet or as a reader and lover of poetry and of spiritual life?
Yes, I really do think in those terms. I mean, it, to me, this sort of poetry can be sort of living. So in my own experience as both a writer and a reader, poet, but also I guess I'm also thinking of my nonfiction, but mainly as a poet, my spiritual experience does end up factoring into what I'm pouring out on the page, whether it's something from long ago or something more immediate and urgent. And when I'm reading other texts, as I just said, it can open up channels in me. But conversely, poetry also does something in return. So it's kind of this reciprocal thing. When I'm even writing a poem, it often surprises me and gives me new insights. It's almost like it's speaking back to me. Then much later, lines from my own work or the work of other poets may come to me at kind of pivotal moments to give me wisdom or encouragement or something else I need right then. So the poetry kind of comes around and speaks back to me.
Okay, that's well said. I love that. That rings true. I've just got to ask quickly. So you were so generous coming to my class yesterday, and we've been reading and discussing your poetry for a few weeks there, and the students were deeply familiar with it, and they loved it. Were you surprised by anything in the class?
I was absolutely stunned and amazed by your students. And one of
whom is Starly, here. Starly's in the class, yes.
They were amazing. And they there was just such a depth in the way they had engaged with the poems, the questions they brought. I was shocked at the number of poems, the diversity of the poems that they were bringing forward. I loved it that everyone seemed to have like a different poem that resonated with them. That meant so much to me. It was just all wonderful. Thank you so much.
Oh, it was a highlight of the semester for all the students. I was joking that, you know, we should have done this in December because now it's all downhill from here and it's going to hurt my student ratings, right? It's going to hurt them. Well, thank you for coming. It was amazing. So you got to come back one day and do this again.
I would love
right?
that.
Yeah,
yes.
This has got to be
thank
a second,
you so
not
much.
A one-time only experience. Let me conclude a couple questions here for you. So your experience as a poet is of writing your own poetry, right? And you learning techniques that work for you and perfecting your craft and seeking inspired tropes or turns of phrase and so on. But you're also a reader of poetry, and I'm wondering whether you would agree with me that this is really a pretty remarkable period right now for religious poetry. I'm thinking especially of Christian poetry. And I'm wondering whether you have any sense for why this is. And it's a compelling question for me because most people would say that it's not necessarily an especially great time for Christianity in our broader society, right? It's so polarized, so combative, and membership in many Christian communities is declining. And there's a fair amount of animosity between Christian and non-Christian groups in our society. So with all that going on, do you have any theory for why Christian poetry is thriving?
Yeah, I really agree with you that it would seem to be the opposite. So I guess my theory, if I had to offer a theory, would be we're living in times with a really apocalyptic feel. And, you know, everywhere we look, there's war, political crisis, extreme weather, like we just had in Florida, drought, fire, flood. And I think there's an urgency and a sorrow in this, in the world, and for all of our generations, and I think especially for our younger generations. And I think that invites religious inquiry and poetic response. And I know for myself, I feel an impetus to try to do what I can to put light in the world. That's really all the only way I can describe it, because I feel like that's the only thing I can offer, to put light into the world. And I believe that may be the motivation of others also.
That's a great answer. That's true. That rings true to me at many levels. I mean, I'm not a poet, but my own way, I've felt the same impetus to try to do that. This podcast is one manifestation of that, right?
And it does.
And other things that I've been trying to write over the last few years, and that's felt, I think, widely. And I thank you for putting so much light into the world, I've got to say, because this is beautiful work that is definitely it's sophisticated, but also deeply uplifting. It's wonderful. One last question for you, what we have time for here, but kind of back to talking about why you're here on campus today. You're giving this every semester, main semester, we have a distinguished lecture called the Faith and Imagination Lecture, and you are the Faith and Imagination Lecturer. Yay. And you're also doing a poetry reading here. So when this episode drops, this is all in the rearview mirror, but I'm just interested if you can tell listeners what you plan to discuss for us today in both the reading and the lecture.
Well, I'm so excited about today. This is in kicking it off with you, Matt. And by the way, thank you for the light that you put in the world through this podcast and all the work that you do. So I will be doing a poetry reading today. I'll be reading from Litany of Lights and Butterfly Nebula and some new poems. And I will be lecturing later on my I Live No Longer I book, which is a book about Paul's spirituality of suffering, transformation, and joy, and also reading poems during that lecture. So I'm so excited for the very first time to not just be only giving a theology lecture or only doing a poetry reading, but this is a wonderful experiment, which I hope will work, on joining the two together and speaking a little about a few concepts from the book and sharing poems that I think kind of intersect with those concepts. And I love it that thank you for inviting me to do that, because I feel like it is of a piece. It's an integrated whole, and it's two lenses on the same thing. So thank you, and I'm thrilled to be doing that today.
Well, it sounds great, and I can't wait. And it's so great to have you here, Laura. Thank you so much for being here to lecture, and for your poetry, and for your friendship. It means a lot to me. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the same, Matt. I'm so grateful. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination Podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Starley Pratt. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips and Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.